Okay, this is day four at the 56th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother Ron Hoban on Dirt to Diamonds. His subtitle for today is Chief Cornerstone. This is the third talk in his series. The introductory reading is Ephesians chapter 2, starting at verse 11 to the end. Brother Ron.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Oh, that was nice. Good morning, Gordon. Oh, 2 seconds. I just got to grab my clicker. Okay. So we're continuing on our theme of dust to diamonds, with the overall key quote being this one here in 2 Corinthians, that we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power might be of God and not of us. And so just a reminder, we were looking at God's work in the garden with the formation of man, but also those incredible resources that came out of that area. So we've looked at our first one in terms of our appreciation of our making, that we are essentially clay creatures or dirt bags as such, and that was an inward focus for us to see and get our perspective right in terms of our relationship to God. And then yesterday we looked at the aspect of the quality that God sees in us and our diversity through looking at the different gemstones which are found throughout the biblical record. Today we're going to look at this aspect of being built upon a foundation which is Christ, and we're going to see how that again comes out of the story of the garden, and it's an essential part of the story of the garden. And in this we're going to see that our dynamic growth happens through our relationship to Christ, and we should always remember our foundation as such in thinking about what we are built on. And that reading in Ephesians was a pretty good reading. So just a quick thing, recapping on yesterday's story of the gems, and we looked at the story of polishing gems. One thing I wanted to sort of bring out with that, because we talked about the different characters and we looked at the different personality tests that you have, and the danger, as we said, with personality tests is putting people into a box. One of the things that comes out of it that we looked at the end is the gemstones that were anisotropic reacted to the light, and it's Christ which is the one that does the polishing, not us. And it's Christ which interacts with the gemstones. It's the light which changes them. And perhaps I can give you a good example is that, thinking about the disciples, I did quite a bit of work on the disc analysis, or you might say the cherubim analysis, with different disciples that we know of. And two stand out really clear that we know really well, and that is John and Peter. And when you go through the gospel records, you'll see that John is an extreme depersonality. He is the face of the eagle, and John is like the eagle. Eagles, like strategic foresight, everything's black and white. Depersonalities are full of energy. Jesus called them Boanerges, sons of thunder, really strong. They are very protective of their own, extremely protective. John was like that with Jesus, wasn't he? We saw one casting out devils in your name, and we stopped them. We forbade them. Boom. Can be judgmental. Wilt thou that we bring fire down from heaven and destroy them, as Elijah did? Peter, on the other hand, is very high I personality, which is where I fall into that category. A people's person. He's an encourager, enthusiastic. They're very much both strong leaders, full of energy, but D personalities and I personalities often clash because very different leadership styles. One wants to get behind the group and to encourage and say, let's go and let's do this, whereas the D personality is like, follow me, boom, off there. So D personalities tend to be CEOs and directors, have strategic foresight, whereas I personalities are often like coaches, you know, people that work in and with people because they love people. One of the things in this is if anyone's done the five love languages, you'll find that they fit really well with personalities as well. So for instance, I personalities tend to love words of affirmation as a love language because they're people, you know, they're people pleasers. They like to be. D personalities, which is interesting with John, are very, very family connected. They're strong in protection of their own. And one of the love languages which comes out, you know, you can see that with Peter. He was looking for words of affirmation. With John, what's interesting is the touching, feeling, connection. And John was like that because he was the one that leant against Jesus' breast. He was the one that said, oh, Lord, we want to sit one on your right hand and one on your left hand in your kingdom. Because when you look at the eagle, God says in Deuteronomy 32, the eagle hovers over its young and it flutters over them and it protects them and it wants to be close to them. That's what John was like with Jesus. It's like, you're mine. And no one else is having you. He was really close. Now here's something interesting. When you go through the Gospels, John is off the chart D personality. Where is he in the epistles? He is off the chart S personality. The S personality is caring. It's about family connection. It's about bond. He is completely changed from that like judgmental dynamic character of the Gospel. He's become like this intense fatherly figure. What's happened? Jesus has taken all that energy and says, oh, it's great that you want to protect me and you want me to be your own. I want you to do that with the whole family. I want you to do that with the brotherhood. And so he talks to his little children and he talks to fathers. And all of a sudden, his community grows. It becomes dynamic, and because of that, all of that energy is changed. Now, that's what Jesus does, and I think that's interesting with the dispersonalities. We all have our natural tendency, our natural personalities, but Jesus has the power to dynamically change us to get the best out of us for a community. But what we have to do is let that light interact with us. So the teaching of Jesus transforms us. It transcends us. It makes us different people. So let's get into our story now, and we're going to again look at these three different things that came out, which were there in the land of Havilah, specifically recorded in Genesis chapter 2. Yesterday we looked at the onyx. Today we want to look at this subject of the gold. And as we said in Genesis, this gold is quite specific. So when you look at that Genesis chapter 2 record, it says in verse 12 and or in verse 11, out of the land was four rivers that came, and the first was Pishon, and it flowed around the whole land of Havilah where there is gold. And it's so interesting that the Bible says that, but then it adds this, and the gold of that land is good. So why does it tell you this? And here's something really interesting. The word for gold, kedar, Again, if we did the pictorial, it's really interesting. It has connection with agriculture and harvesting. We talk about the golden grains. It's actually got the sickle. So it's sort of like what comes out of the ground that we see as gold is like a golden harvest. What's under the ground, which is mined, is the precious stone of gold. So this word kedar, used a lot through the Bible, but associated with the word tob, which is the word good, it is only together in one other place in the whole of the Bible, in the Old Testament. Now, I find that really interesting, because it's like you only find good gold in one other place, and there's an intimate connection with the story of the gold of the land of Havilah, which was good, and the story of Solomon building the temple. So when Solomon built the temple, it said, of the greater house, he sealed with fir wood, and he overlaid it with good gold, top gold. He wrought thereof palm trees and chains, and garnished the house with precious stones for beauty. And the gold was the gold of Parvaim. Now I'm not sure if you've ever heard of who's heard of the gold of Parvaim until now, or ever sort of really noticed that before? Anyone noticed that before? You've probably heard of the gold of Ophir. The gold of Ophir is all through the construction of Solomon's temple. He used the gold of Ophir in all sorts of places. But when it comes to the greater house, which is incidentally the Holy of Holies, the great house within, the inner house, he put special gold. He overlaid the greater house with the gold of Parvaim. So he had high quality gold, which he used. Obviously, he didn't have lots of it because he didn't use it quite like he used the gold of Ophir. So what is this gold of Parvaim? Interestingly enough, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were in the caves of Qumran, which were probably read by the Essenes, there were a whole lot of other books, and many of the apocryphal writings were found there. And we don't necessarily hold a lot of credence to the apocryphal writings, but some of them are very useful, especially for history. The books of Maccabees we use a lot for history. But one of them is the Genesis Apocryphon. And in the Genesis Apocryphon, it has this record of after Enoch was translated and taken away to be protected, it says that Methuselah sent Lamech. That's not the bad Lamech, that's the good Lamech. He sent Lamech to go and inquire of Enoch in Parvaim in Eden. Isn't that interesting? So now I don't know how like true the apocryphal record is, but it's suggesting that God translated Enoch and protected him in the land of Eden. He was somehow protected back in the land of Eden, in a place called Parvaim. Now, it's very interesting that Solomon went out of his way to build, it says, a port at Ebion Giza in the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, why do you want to build a port there? Because most travel was done through the Mediterranean. But if you wanted to go into the cradle of civilization, into the Persian Gulf, and you were sailing from the Mediterranean, it's a pretty big trip because you've got to go right around the whole of Africa to get around to go to the Persian Gulf. But if you've got a port at the Gulf of Aqaba, it's pretty easy to get into a boat, go out of the Gulf of Aqaba, around to the Persian Gulf, right up into the land of Parvaim. And I think Solomon was a bit of a gold hunter. And I think that's what was used in the building of the temple. Now, that's fascinating in our story in the Genesis record, isn't it? So the first temple, the heart of the temple, was overlaid with this pure gold. But it was only in the heart of the temple. And when Solomon made the temple, there was an enormous amount of work, around the stones which were used for building of the temple. It says in 2 Kings, when the house was built, it was prepared with stones so that it was prepared outside, off-site. They got these stonemasons and they got these stones and they prepared them so that no hammer, no saw, or no sound could be heard in the construction in and around the temple. So all of these were bored in, these massive stones. And so every stone was bored in to build the temple, except for one. What stone was not bored in for the building of the temple? There was one stone which was already there. Because the whole temple was built upon a stone which was prepared. This temple was built upon the threshing floor of Mount Moriah. And it specifically says in 2 Chronicles, Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in Mount Moriah, where the Lord appeared to him. God gave him instructions as where to build it, and he was to build it at a place in Mount Moriah. Now, we know what happens at Mount Moriah, don't we? This is the place where there was an altar at the top of Mount Moriah. This was the place where Abraham went to offer up his son Isaac, and God intervened and said, stop. And death was interrupted at that moment. And then God said, in this place, you will see it. You will see it because I will offer my son. You're not going to offer yours today, Abraham. I will offer my son in this place. And your seed will possess the gate of his enemies. Now, incidentally, this is the leading expert in the world on this subject is Lane Rittmeyer. And you'll see that I've taken photos of Lane's thing and he's got copyright on there. Rest assured, I have actually purchased these. I have purchased them. I just haven't got the copies yet. So I am actually allowed to be using these. This is from Rittmeyer Archaeological Design. And this is his picture of this Mount Moriah. And you'll see up there, on the right at the top, is the threshing floor. And beside it is the rock. The rock of Mount Moriah. And in Isaiah, in chapter 28, it says, behold, I am the one who has laid the foundation of Zion. God already chose the stone. It was already there before Solomon started. This was a stone prepared without hands. This was a stone prepared by God, the foundation stone of the temple, a tried and tested, a precious cornerstone, a special rock. And it says, this rock, of course, was going to be a sanctuary, but it's also going to become a major problem. It's going to become a stumbling block that many people are going to fall over and be snared and be taken. Now that quote, we're going to come back to it, but that quote is used three times in the New Testament, once by Jesus and twice by Paul. So we're going to come back and look at that, particularly in our last study. But this stone actually really did become a stumbling block because later on in the days of Ahaz, he wanted to remove the altar of burnt offering, which was upon that rock. That was the big rock where they built the altar of burnt offering, which was a huge altar, and he wanted that out of the way because he wanted to put his own altar there. So he moved it out of the way, and he put his own idol there to worship, but the problem is he couldn't move the stone. And so lots of people were tripping up when they were going to worship his little idols up there, and it literally became a stone of stumbling. And it's still a stone of stumbling, because this is Lane Rittmeyer's great work to show that the stone is right smack there in the middle of the Dome of the Rock today. So every stone in Solomon's temple came down, every stone in Herod's temple came down. Not one stone left upon another, but there's one stone that has never moved. That stone remains constant. And it's a stone of stumbling because that stone is Christ. It's a stone of stumbling to Israel. It's a stone of stumbling to Islam. It's a stone of stumbling to the world. So, Solomon had a passion towards gold and women, didn't he? The Deuteronomy 17 says, "You shall not accumulate, the king should not accumulate or acquire many wives." Now, I'm not sure if Solomon read that and said, "Define many." So, Solomon's definition of many, wow. I think it was Suzanne once told me, teaching the Chinese, they said that Solomon had 300 wives and 700 porcupines. Well, they could be rather prickly, couldn't they? So he says, "Don't acquire to yourself many wives, lest your heart turn away, and don't acquire to himself excessive amounts of silver and gold." So that's what the record says in Deuteronomy. A king shouldn't acquire many wives or excessive amounts of silver and gold. But it says Solomon in 1 year received 666 talents of gold. Interesting number, isn't it? 666 talents of gold. He made 200 yard shields of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. And then he made all these steps going up, all made of gold, these gold lions. Again, six steps, 12 lions. There's an ongoing theme within Solomon's house in terms of the coincidence of the number six. Incidentally, when you look at the building of the temple, you'll see number seven is used a lot in the building of the temple. And here's an interesting thing. So Chronicles 1 verse 15 says, "The king made silver and gold as plentiful as stones." So stones in Israel, there's quite a lot of them. And Solomon made silver and gold as plentiful as stones. And he did it with the help of this man. And this becomes a very interesting story to our story on the chief cornerstone and to our story on this special gold. And what we're going to do is follow this story a little bit, and hopefully we're going to come to a real little gold nugget at the end of this. Special little gold nugget. So this whole arrangement with Solomon came through an agreement, an international agreement between Hiram, the king of Tyre. That's up in the area of Lebanon. It was originally given to the tribe of Asher, but they didn't take that inheritance. And so the king of Tyre had a friendship with David. And out of that friendship with David, David sort of suggested to Solomon that maybe he could use the help of Hiram for building the temple. This was the single biggest commercial contract that had ever existed. For Hiram, this was cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. Now, the building of this temple and all the auxiliary buildings that Solomon went on to make, that was a big contract. And Hiram was a specialist in it. So the Phoenicians sent their boats out and they went around all around the Mediterranean, and they collected all the silver and gold, and they brought in abundance silver and gold. But one of the other things that Hiram brought in to Solomon was lots of women as well. So part of Solomon's harem came from Hiram. Harem's harem. So anyway, Psalm 45, it's I think this has a wonderful application to Hezekiah as well, but we're not going to talk about that. But in Psalm 45, verse 12, it says, "The daughter of Tyre, the wealthy people, will seek your favor with gifts." So Hiram went and sought favor with Solomon. They made this agreement, and Hiram helped Solomon build it, the temple, and provided him with all of these resources. Incredible amount of resources. But we learn he didn't just provide him with resources, he provided him with people resources as well, skilled labor, artisans that were able to, stonemasons that were able to cut stones. He was able to provide people that could work with gold, precious stones, and he also provided him with these women. And you can see the connection here in Psalm 45. Princesses among the honoured women, which are part of the gifts, that the bride stands on your right hand, and look what she's wearing. She's wearing jewellery made with the gold of Ophir. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 11, Hiram's fleet carried gold from Ophir and also brought from Ophir a very large quantity of fine timber and precious gems. So Hiram provided Solomon with the gold of Ophir, and when you read Psalm 45, it's very interesting that this bride is decked out with precious stones in the gold of Ophir, and specifically said, the people of Tyre, the wealthy, shall seek favour and seek your favour with gifts. So this was the first time Israel had entered into a formal relationship with a Gentile nation. So they entered into a formal agreement, a commercial agreement, for the purpose of the construction and building of the temple. And everything was going swimmingly between the two. It was a great relationship. Hiram was intimately involved with the building of the temple, intimately involved with the design, the construction, the decorating of it. He was the provider of the skilled labour and all the resources. So it was all going pretty good until Solomon gave him a bonus. So it says in 1 Kings chapter 9 that Solomon gave to Hiram 20 cities of the towns of Galilee. So he gave him 20 cities of the towns of Galilee, and when Hiram went down and looked at these cities, he is not happy. He was very, very ungrateful for this gift, because down in these cities, he called them kabul, which means sterile. See, the problem with Tyre, they had amazing resources of gold and minerals, but what they lacked was the gold that came above the ground. They actually lacked the golden grain. They had massive food issues. They still do today, by the way. Lebanon today has one of the most major shortages of cereal in the world today. And while Hiram traded with Solomon, as he gave Solomon gold and silver and precious stones, Solomon in return gave him wheat and barley, because that's what they needed. So he traded bread for gold. I just find that interesting. The gold that came above the ground and the gold that came beneath. You know, Solomon gave him the gold from above, Hiram gave him the gold that comes from under the ground. It's just an interesting little play. And the word for gold connects both of those things. The word kedar is used as the idea of the golden grain above and what gold comes from beneath. So everything went well until, of course, the problem was Solomon's led astray by all the wives that come from Tyre and Sidon. So it's the women that were given to Solomon which caused a massive problem. And he followed after the gods. And it was the woman that led Solomon down a terrible path and saw the demise of this kingdom. So all of its glory, which started in the days of Hiram, turned sour because of this relationship. And when Jesus told the parable of a wise man that built a house upon a rock and a foolish man that built a house upon sand, I think he's talking about one man. Because one man began building a house upon a rock, and that rock was the foundation stone that God had laid. He finished building gods made of sand that he fell down and worshipped. And that's why Jesus uses Solomon in the example of Matthew chapter 6 as both the wise man and the foolish man to learn of the dangers of following in the footsteps of Solomon. And herein is the reason why when you get to the story of Ezekiel chapter 27 and 28, you get this. Chapter 26, 27, and 28 are all spoken against the king of Tyre. God is angry with the king of Tyre. And he's angry with the king of Tyre. He said, because I gave you all this glory. I brought you into this relationship. And then you said, oh, I'm perfect in my beauty. You suddenly became proud and arrogant, and then you traded wheat, minith, meal, honey, oil, and goods for your goods. You traded bread for gold, but you became deceitful. And here in chapter 28 is our story of the gems. And this is an explanation as to why you've got this unusual chapter in Ezekiel 28 about the king of Tyre being compared to the high priest. So he's spoken against the king of Tyre and he says, "You were my anointed guardian cherub. I appointed you. You were on my holy mountain. You walked amongst the fiery stones, but you profaned your sanctuaries by the magnitude of your iniquities in your dishonest trade." Well, it's interesting. Hiram was responsible for bringing gold into the building of the temple. Gold from the land of Eden came in and was used in the temple. He walked amongst Eden. He walked amongst the gemstones. He was part of that whole intimate process. He entered into a religious relationship. But then through his arrogancy and his deceitful trade, his ungratefulness, he brought the kingdom down. But God in turn said the city that was built on the rock was about to be destroyed. So in all his power and all his might, Tyre built a whole city upon a rock, a fortress, impenetrable. No one could get in. But of course, God brought judgment upon Tyre through Alexander the Great, who brought the causeway up. I'm sure you know the story, and totally flattened the city. End of Tyre. Until, here's our gold nugget. Our little gold nugget. So let's come to Mark chapter 7 and see something interesting in this. Beautiful little gemstone in this one. So Mark chapter 7 verse 26, or verse 24, Jesus arose from there and he went to the area of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, so he should be hidden. But immediately a woman whose daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to come and cast out the demon of his daughter. Something so amazing, isn't it, when you think about the incredible story of this woman compared to Hiram. So what did Solomon give to Hiram? The cities of Galilee. Do you know, they said, surely this can't be the Christ. Christ can't come out of Galilee. What good thing could come out of Galilee? Galilee of the Gentiles? Nothing good comes from Galilee. Here's the man from Galilee walking into the house of a Syrophoenician, a woman of Tyre. And she's got a daughter that's sick. And she's coming to him and she's pleading with him. And she says, Lord, come and save my daughter. And what does Jesus say to her? It's not right to take the bread and give it to the dogs. Yeah, isn't that interesting in the story of the parable of the bread and the gold? What did Hiram trade with Israel? Bread for gold. So he says, it's not good. And she's going, please, 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 please. And Jesus loved that, didn't it? She says, even the dogs eat the crumbs. I just want the crumbs. She accepted what, like, it was a derogatory statement. You know, take the bread and give it to the dogs. And she says, I'm okay with that. She was totally grateful for the blessing. And there's such a powerful thing here. Know your place at the table. Know where you belong at the table. And she knew that position, where she was at the table. I love this picture, isn't it? Here they all are, the dogs, sitting on the table, pontificating. They've got their Bibles open and expounding. I love this one at the end. So important. That was the failure of Hiram, wasn't it? He didn't appreciate the gift of being associated with the God of Israel. He despised that gift, and in his arrogance he rode up. He wanted more. And so, an interesting thing. You may, this is just a sideline quickly, but this, some of you might find this fascinating. 27th of October this year, something amazing happened, which kind of went a little bit by that a lot of people might not have recognized. But on the 27th of October, who knows what happened on the 27th of October? Was it someone's birthday? Jackie does. She knows exactly what happened. Exactly. This is the first maritime agreement, a first formal agreement between Israel and an Arab nation since Hiram and Solomon. Since Hiram and Solomon. There has never been a formal maritime agreement between. And this agreement, and what's interesting in this agreement, Lebanon wanted to make it very clear they still did not recognize Israel's right to exist. We don't recognize Israel's right to exist, but we're happy to make an agreement because there's a lot of benefits in this agreement, because there's a lot of money to be made from it, because it's to do with the oil and gas fields that have been, you know, discovered. And not only is it shared territory from the maritime agreement, but also Israel has the capability to be able to mine, what's the word for it? Drill and extract the oil and gas that's in those areas. So this agreement, you know, has five clauses, and it's so fascinating that this agreement is very much like the agreement of Hiram and Solomon. I find that interesting, especially when you're looking at where that area is. Because, by the way, it is in the area of the tribe of Asher, and then there's this beautiful quote in Deuteronomy of Asher, and it says, "Most blessed be Asher, let him be favoured amongst his brothers." Why favoured amongst his brothers of all? Why Asher? "And let him dip his foot in oil." Interesting. So I find that fascinating. But now we come back to our connection to all of this. In our story of the tried and precious stone and the reading we read in Ephesians, it's so interesting when you see the connection to the tried and precious stone, especially with the Syrophoenician woman. Jesus said, "It's not time. It's not time for me to give. It's not right for me to take the children's meat and give it to the dogs. It wasn't the time. But the time is now. Consequently, you are no longer foreigners. You are no longer strangers, but you are fellow citizens. It's the right time. You are members of God's household. You are built into this house. And you are built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself being the chief cornerstone." And there's some beautiful quotes, isn't there? Where Peter says, "Knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways you inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ." What was that foundation stone all about? That was the altar that Abraham was going to offer up Isaac. That was the place where God said it would be seen. That would be the place where I will offer my son. You are redeemed through the precious blood of Christ. And you are come to him as a living stone. He's alive. Rejected of men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious. Gold is the most precious stone. And we've been built upon Christ. And the whole building fits together. So we come to the only other place. I said that there's only two places that the fine gold is mentioned in the Bible. That's kind of true, because that's in the Hebrew. But there is one other place where fine gold is used. Revelation chapter 21. You see, whilst Solomon lined the heart of the temple, just that little bit, the Holy of Holies, with the gold of Parvaim, the fine gold, when you come to Revelation chapter 21, we learned about the gates and the walls and the 12 apostles. But where are we in Revelation chapter 21? Where are you and I in Revelation 21 in the story? Revelation chapter 21 in verse 18, it says, "And the entire city," the entire city is the gold of Parvaim. It's pure gold, and so pure is this gold, it's like glass. So now you've got the highest quality gold, and the entire city is gold. That's where we are in this city. We've been brought into this. Because in life, Jesus' teaching is that which is transforming, it's transparent, and it's transcending. And I think what that means, you know, for me in my life is, and for you in your life is, this is a living stone. It's not just Christ's words that are active in our lives. Christ himself is active in our life. He is alive in our life, and he is constantly refining this gold in our life. And sometimes when you go through the same trial over and over again, it's because he's trying to refine something in our lives. He's wanting that gold to get better. And I had a great example that I had with the teens. Recently, well, last year, still this year actually, so this year, early on in the year, I had a very difficult client that I was dealing with. And it all started off lovely, and it really turned real pear-shaped, and it made me lose a lot of sleep over it. And at the time, I was going through a lot of different things, particularly with what was happening with mum and dad and lots of stresses. And I kind of reacted in a way that I regretted. And I thought that I reacted this way and it would all turn out good, but I reacted in quite a confrontational way, and it turned into an absolute disaster. It went really, really pear-shaped. So later this year, I almost had the exact thing happen again, and I was under pressure. It's only happened like about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I was like, oh no, this client has a twin. I've got the same client again. And it's so interesting that this time, because of what had happened, I really sought the Lord in prayer. Right to the point where even as I was going to visit this client, I sought in prayer what I was going to do in this situation, because I'd seen what had happened the first time. And I kept thinking about, you know, what is the right approach? And Jesus' teaching is so transforming, so transparent. It turns things upside down. It does things that are not natural. It says when someone steals from you, give them something else. Now, that's not natural. You know, someone hits you on the face, turn the other side. That's just, Jesus' teaching's all backward to what the world would teach you. And so I went in there with the whole focus to try to do the backward thing. And this client was being like utterly ridiculous about, you know, what they were accepting and not accepting. And she said, well, you know, I'm okay with that, but I'm not okay with that. And I was like, no, that's not good enough either. I'll take that and I'll fix that. And she was like, what? So I just basically took the whole lot and started again. I said, no, I'll take that, I'll fix that. That's not good enough either. That's not good enough either. Oh, and I was finding stuff. No, I think I should fix that. And by the end of it, she was like, what? Like, I can imagine she's been a difficult customer and had the same response. She's probably never had that response before. She was blown away. In the end, it was like, I felt so good about it. I actually enjoyed fixing all these problems because it was great. And the end result was an amazing thing. But it just shows you that when you apply this principle of the Lord's teaching, it's so rewarding. It does the opposite to what you think. It really is rewarding. And I think that's the dynamic nature of Christ refining us as to be pure gold. And when we do this in our businesses, in our families, in our ecclesias, if we're constantly trying to do this, we'll grow. And this is what we're going to look at in our last study. This whole idea is this is a building which is dynamic. Like all of those stones that Solomon used, they're dead. They fell down. All the stones that which were built in Herod's temple, they're gone. But we're built upon a living stone. We're built upon a foundation which is alive, and this building continues to grow. And it will only grow if we're built upon that foundation. And our lives will become dynamic and not stagnant. Even so, come Lord Jesus.